It is Friday, May the 6th. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, who holds the cards in Syria, Russia or the U.S.?
The main card that they hold is that they seem to have influence with the government of President Assad. And the assumption is that the United States has influence with both rebels who have received American assistance.
Also ahead, political changes in Turkey, solving Vietnam's water problems, plus something new, so to speak, from the Rolling Stones. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. and Russian brokers brokered local ceasefire in the Syrian city of Aleppo. That's right, where fierce fighting between the government and rebels has resulted in more than 280 civilian deaths, all of that since late April. Just a few hours after that, opposition politicians said warplanes, either Syrian government or Russian, carried out a deadly airstrike on a refugee camp close to the border with Turkey. At least 30 were killed there, dozens more wounded. Even with the ceasefire breaches, Oregon State University scholar Peter Bechtol tells VOA's Victor Beatty, there are some observers with optimism this current ceasefire will not actually end.
The hope is that this can be extended, just like war is being extended, so ceasefires can be extended. At least that's the hope.
This does not cover the terrorist groups like Islamic State or al-Nusra, which are fairly close to Aleppo, so there's the chance that the militants will continue attacks.
Exactly. In my opinion, it's never smart to freeze out some members of a conflict and keep others in. Part of the city is controlled by the Nusra Front, part of it is controlled by the rebels, and part of it is controlled by the government. And there's even a small Kurdish enclave.
Let's talk about the overall strategic picture here. It appears that Aleppo seems to be a key objective for both sides. One or the other may ultimately prevail in this five-year conflict if they're able to secure Aleppo. Is that your opinion?
Oh, yes. Aleppo, before the war started, was the most populous city in Syria. It's been a key place in history, and you could argue that it's strategically more important on the route of the Fertile Crescent, connecting Turkey with the Arab world. You have to more or less go through Aleppo, and also connecting Iraq and Syria.
Both sides are heavily invested in this. Obviously, you've underscored the strategic value of Aleppo, so isn't it in the interest of both sides ultimately to try to retake it, which means more violence?
Well, it doesn't have to be that. Muslims, Christians, Jews, even Druze, Kurds, they've lived side by side.
What does this all tell you about the dynamic between the U.S. and Russia? Does Russia seem to hold the cards here?
They hold some cards. They certainly hold more cards than the U.S. does. But they don't hold as many cards as they did 2 months ago, because they have pulled out the majority of their forces. The main card that they hold is that they seem to have influence with the government of President Assad. And the assumption is that the United States has influence with both rebels who have received American assistance. And that if you take those two into a ceasefire, you're still left with al-Nusra and the Islamic State, and you're left with the Kurds, and they have to be included in an overall settlement.
How likely is the proximity talks in Geneva to resume and become more substantive than they have?
If the ceasefire holds for 48 hours, that's the time for Geneva to work as hard as they can and see if they can come up with a political accommodation. You have to walk back some of the positions.
And as Oregon State University scholar Peter Bechtol, he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. U.S. Defense Department spokesman Colonel Stephen Warren says U.S. warships have stopped accompanying U.S. and British flag commercial vessels through the Strait of Hormuz. They have accompanied them. Edward Uranian reporting from the VOA Middle East Bureau in Cairo that Iran has threatened to close the waterway to U.S. and allied vessels.
The threat to close the Strait of Hormuz follows an announcement last week by Iran's naval commander, Admiral Habiballah Sayari, that his country would hold maneuvers in the Persian Gulf in the near future. The deputy head of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, General Hussein Salami, told state TV Wednesday that Iran would close the strait to U.S. and allied commercial vessels if it came under threat. The general says that if the United States and its regional allies want to go through the Strait of Hormuz and threaten Iran, it will not allow their ships to enter the area. He added that the United States should learn from recent history, alluding to Iran's brief detention of a 10-member U.S. Navy crew last January. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, told a gathering Sunday the Persian Gulf is Iran's home and that his great nation has a right to be there. He went on to urge the United States to conduct its own naval maneuvers in the Bay of Pigs. A resolution passed in the U.S. Congress last week stating that Iran has undermined the stability in the Gulf, increasing the dangers of an inadvertent conflict, is reportedly what angered Iran's leaders. Former Iranian diplomat and analyst Mirdad Kansari argues Iranian threats to close the Strait of Hormuz are not new and are mostly rhetorical exercises.
What they are trying to do is to say that they are active and independent and powerful and can confront anybody. But the fact is that if you scratch the surface, the reality is that the Iranian Navy is incapable of blocking the Strait of Hormuz.
Kansari says Iran usually makes grandiose statements in the lead-up to military maneuvers, and they are mostly intended for internal consumption. Some Arab analysts suggest Tehran is trying to project an image of power to its citizens at a time when it is seeing heavy casualty numbers in Syria. The U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet is based in the Gulf island state of Bahrain, which is not far from the Strait of Hormuz. U.S. Navy warships have periodically accompanied commercial vessels through the strait when Iran has threatened to accost them. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Among the top stories we're following this hour, Britain's Muslims see London's mayor race as a victory. Last known Tiananmen prisoner to be released, plus pop icon Prince quietly helping Afghan orphans for many years. Expanded coverage of these stories plus more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Turkey's Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu has announced he will step down as his ruling AK party announced an extraordinary Congress to elect a new leader. Davutoğlu's decision comes amid reports of his growing differences with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Dorian Jones is in Istanbul with our report.
In a carefully worded statement to the country's media, Prime Minister Davutoğlu said he'll be stepping down at the AK Party Congress to be held on May the 22nd. Davutoğlu claimed his premiership has been a success, underlying his landslide victory in last November's election. But alluding to growing differences over his leadership, he said he was stepping down for the sake of unity and consensus in his party. But the Prime Minister was careful to reaffirm his loyalty to the President.
Hiç kimse benim ağzımdan, benim dilimden, benim zihnimden Cumhurbaşkanımız aleyhine tek bir söz duymadı.
I feel no reproach, anger or resentment against anyone, he said, adding, no one heard or will ever hear a single word from my mouth, from my tongue or my mind against our president. But in the past few months, there have been reports of growing differences between the Prime Minister and Erdogan. Supporters of the president have accused Davutoğlu of opposing Erdogan's ambitions of replacing Turkey's current parliamentary system with a presidential one, while Davutoğlu has tentatively voiced concerns over a growing crackdown on critics of the president. On Monday, Erdogan loyalists in the AK party stripped the prime minister of his power to appoint regional party heads, while the president this week issued a thinly veiled warning to Davutoglu, saying he should remember who appointed him. Davutoglu met Wednesday with Erdogan to resolve their differences, but Cengiz Aktar, a political scientist at Istanbul's Süleyman Şah University, says the prime minister's fate was already sealed.
For some time now, he was growing in his position, and that is unacceptable to Mr. Erdogan. He is and he was his creation, and he started to become independent. I mean, developing new ideas, etc., which didn't please to Mr. Erdogan, and he pushed him out.
One of the prime minister's initiatives was to craft a deal with the European Union, whereby Turkey accepted migrants returned from Greece in exchange for a series of concessions, including visa-free travel to Schengen zone countries in the European Union. This week, the European Commission gave a conditional green light to visa-free travel. While Brussels has made little secret of the fact that it would rather deal with Davutoglu than Erdogan, who is increasingly accused of authoritarianism, observers say Davutoglu's removal sends a message that Erdogan is the only person who wields power in Turkey. Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, leader of Turkey's main opposition, Republican People's Party, called the prime minister's resignation a palace coup. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
And you can get more on this story, plus the rest of the hour's news, at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. VOA. Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. United Nations reports that 2.5 billion people worldwide do not have access to adequate sanitation, and more than 760 million are without clean water. One of the organizations dedicated to providing clean water and better sanitation is the U.S.-based development agency East Meets West, which are working to improve those conditions specifically in Vietnam. I spoke with the group's president, John Anner, about his work and how it all got started.
We were founded just about 25 years ago by a woman who was originally from Vietnam, got caught up in the Vietnam War, and then left before the war ended and came to the U.S. She wrote a book about her life. That book was made into a movie. And with this desire to help improve relations between the United States and Vietnam, she launched the East Meets West Foundation.
And what about your work there in the early days?
A lot of what we did was bring Vietnam veterans back to Vietnam so they could get involved in works that were much more constructive and humanitarian in the aftermath of the war. And over the years, we have just grown up in Vietnam, and now for the past 5 years, been expanding outside of Vietnam. So we have four main project areas: clean water and sanitation, education, the third is child health, pediatric health, and the fourth is construction of what we call Vietnam social infrastructure. So this would be hospitals, libraries, schools, things like that. And so now we work not only in Vietnam, but in 7 or 8 other countries in Asia, and most recently we've launched several programs in India.
You mentioned sanitation is one of your concerns. Having been to Southeast Asia, in fact, a number of Asian countries, I've noticed that sanitation is an issue, especially in rural areas. You've gotten a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Let's talk about what the Gates money will help East Meets West do.
The estimates from the countries themselves, that 50% of the Vietnamese people and 80% of Cambodians simply lack any sort of proper sanitation at home. And without proper sanitation, meaning a sanitary latrine or a toilet or some place to go, there's also very poor hygiene practices. So it's hard to keep your hands clean. It's hard to prevent disease from getting into the food and into the water and so on. So the Gates money is for East Meets West is fills a very particular niche, how to deliver large numbers of latrines in a reasonable way, in a way that's cost effective. So an average latrine can cost between $100 and $150. You can do the math. If millions of people need to get those latrines, you're talking about a problem that quickly runs into the tens and then hundreds of millions of dollars.
That is John Anner. He is head of the U.S.-based development agency East Meets West. Now we move along to U.S. politics, where the growing number of Asian American voters doesn't necessarily translate into political clout in the current elections. VOA's Kane Barabaugh has more.
If you're going to do it, so.
Burmese refugee Ma Zin settled in the town of Fort Wayne, Indiana in 2004, after years fleeing from Myanmar's oppressive ruling military junta. 12 years later, she's still working on her English skills, but that hasn't stopped her from becoming a U.S. citizen, a responsibility she cherishes.
Because we've become a citizen of America, it is important that we select a president, because as a citizen, we would like to know what a president can do for us.
The 2016 U.S. presidential election is Zin's first experience participating in a democratic process to choose a leader, a path she is on at the same time democratic reforms are taking hold in her home country of Myanmar. The two are not unrelated to Zin.
Hillary Clinton and Daw Aung San Suu Kyi both have a relationship for changing and bringing Burma's democratization. That is one of the reasons why I would like to see Hillary become president.
While Zin waits to cast her first ballot, this isn't her first opportunity to participate in a U.S. election. Although eligible since 2008, she did not register to vote in the last two presidential elections, overwhelmed by the language barrier and the process.
There's not enough information out there that people don't know how to navigate that system.
Christina Tendia is a community organizer for Asian Americans Advancing Justice, a nonprofit group committed to empowering Asian Americans. She says one way to help new potential voters, particularly in the neighboring state of Illinois, is automatic voter registration, coupled with applying for a driver's license or ID card.
Which would basically automatically register people who are eligible to vote when they interact with the Secretary of State or the DMV.
Asian Americans represent the fastest growing immigrant population in the United States.
We are actually the fastest growing ethnic community in this country.
And have reached numbers Tendia says can increasingly influence the outcome of not just national, but local elections too.
These elections could be won on 100 or a couple hundred votes, which is really incredible and an opportunity for our community to make a difference.
Ma Zin still needs to register to vote for this year's presidential election in November. In the large Burmese community in Fort Wayne where she lives, there is widespread support for Burmese leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Zin is proud that a woman has such a prominent leadership role in her home country and wants to be a part of such a moment in her new country.
We are so proud of it. Now America hopefully will have a woman president.
Hillary Clinton is on track to make history as the first female presidential candidate of a major party. And thanks to voters like Ma Zin, could also be on her way to an historic election night this November. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Thursday was the holiday known as Cinco de Mayo. It's a big day for U.S. partygoers, including Latinos and all others alike. Our social media expert, G. Abby Lee, is here and has all the buzz about the celebration. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. Cinco de Mayo is actually not a big holiday in Mexico, but it's quite popular here in America. It was one of the top 10 trending hashtags Thursday, and Republican frontrunner Donald Trump may have contributed to the popularity online. He posted a photo of himself posing with a taco bowl and captioned it, "Happy Cinco de Mayo. The best taco bowls are made in Trump Tower Grill. I love Hispanics."
Yeah, that's what he said. And isn't there a controversy over whether his restaurant even sells that dish.
Absolutely, especially on his Twitter. When one person pointed out the restaurant doesn't even serve that dish, other people argued it's a Cinco de Mayo special that's been around for years. Others still argued that's not true, according to a reporter who just called the grill. The conversation on Facebook took a different note. One of the most popular replies says, "We Trump supporters love Hispanic American citizens, the legal ones, that is."
I see. So what are the other things people are talking about?
Staying with U.S. politics, hashtag DropOutHillary is a trending hashtag. It's been trending since GOP contenders Ted Cruz and John Kasich dropped out of the race. Neither of the Democratic contenders are commenting on it, but Green Party candidate Jill Stein did. She tweeted, "Seeing hashtag DropOutHillary and hashtag RepublicansForHillary show how divisive the corporate front running candidates are. Let's choose a different path." That got more than 4,000 likes.
And what's her reach on social media?
She has nearly 48,000 followers on Twitter. And to put that into perspective, the three GOP and Democratic contenders have far more followers on Twitter. Trump has 8 million followers, Clinton has 6 million, and Bernie Sanders has 2 million. Steve?
Yeah, and I have 340. What does it say about me? Who knows? Anyway, thanks, G, for joining us. That's our social media guru, G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can find G on Twitter. She has a lot of followers, and you should be one of them at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and you can also follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? A security camera with face recognition technology made by a French company called Netatmo. When family members enter a home, the smart camera recognizes them and notifies the homeowner's smartphone. If an intruder enters a home, the owner's smartphone sounds an alarm. The camera worked as advertised for Damien, a homeowner in Paris, during what he thought was just another typical day at work.
The notification on my phone was telling me that there was a movement in my flat and also a face that the app did not recognize.
So the French businessman looked at the video and, well, there goes the typical day at work.
I saw a person I did not know with his shoes on, which is totally forbidden in my apartment. So I felt totally frozen, stupefied.
Damien showed the video to the police. The burglar was caught later in the day. He was sentenced to 9 months in prison. They took his shoes. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosso.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. Presumptive Republican U.S. presidential nominee Donald Trump has been no stranger to controversy. We've talked a lot about it on this program. In fact, he seems to embrace it. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joins International Edition host Jim Stevenson to discuss an opponent Mr. Trump may find a little more difficult than Hillary Clinton.
Donald Trump is going up against something even bigger than the Democratic Party, the Rolling Stones. They want Trump to stop using their music at his rallies. Now, he's used their songs for months, among them You Can't Always Get What You Want and Start Me Up. Well, on Wednesday, the Stones issued a statement saying they did not give Donald Trump permission to use their music, and they would like him to cease and desist. Now, at this time, the Trump campaign has yet to respond. This isn't the first time that the Donald has bumped heads with some musical stars. He's also used music from Elton John, Adele, and Aerosmith. Now, Adele and Steve Tyler of Aerosmith both asked Trump to stop using their songs. So did Neil Young. Trump was using Rockin' in the Free World last year. The Trump campaign did comply in those cases. They stopped using the songs. Political campaigns don't need artists' permission to use their songs as long as the organization or the venue has obtained a blanket license from the BMI or ASCAP performing rights organizations. Now, BMI says it does have a provision in its licensing agreement that allows songwriters or publishers to object to the use of their songs, and they do have the right to exclude those particular songs from the blanket licensing. So I suppose the Stones could go that way if they license their songs through BMI. You know, this isn't the first time that politicians have run afoul of music artists. There's kind of a long history of sometimes tone-deaf usage of these songs. And the one that really sticks out in my mind is the Ronald Reagan campaign's usage of Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA in the 1984 presidential election. And, of course, Reagan was using it in a patriotic sense, when in fact, if you listen to the song, it's very sharply critical of the U.S. and its policies. So I think sometimes the campaign workers really need to listen to the music a little more carefully before they put it on the PA system. So we'll just have to wait and see how the Trump campaign reacts to this latest request from the Stones.
Yeah, campaigns over the years have made some very interesting musical choices. And I'm glad you answered that question about the licensing, because I always wondered what that was all about with the public performance angle of it. And because not just anybody can go out and play songs like that in a public performance setting. There are laws and licensing requirements.
Well, more often than not, the politicians back down and stop using the songs, at least temporarily. But they have a pretty plentiful supply of other songs to choose from.
We talked about this outside of the studio. Perhaps Get Off My Cloud is the appropriate Stone song for
and you can't always get
campaign.
What you want, Donald.
Absolutely. Well, we get what we want every time we speak with Ray McDonald. He's our Top 20 Countdown host. Follow Ray on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Thank you, Ray.
You got it.
No way I'd get on their cloud, would you, huh? No way. Elvin Bishop, how about this? Eddie Clearwater, Jimmy Johnson, John Mayall, and the Memphis Jug Band. What do they have in common? They just were inducted into the Blues Hall of Fame. It happened last night in the U.S. city of Memphis, Tennessee. Big night for the five inductees honored by the Blues Foundation here in the United States. Big deal. If you like blues music, for sure you should check out them. They're all great performers, all of them. Every last one. Here's a quick story for you. A video game that allowed players to zap marching aliens with dot lasers, and another that gave them flamethrowers and put them in the driver's seat in the violent 3D world are among six games inducted now into the World Video Game Hall of Fame. Space Invaders, that's the one, and also you can't forget Grand Theft Auto 3. There are a bunch of others inducted. All these inductees are amazing. Thanks for joining us on the Voice of America for International Edition. Very good to have you with us. Top World News is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leading figure with one of the groups conducting attacks in the Sahel and other areas of North Africa, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, or AQIM. Yahya Abu al-Hammam has played a key role in perpetuating the group's terrorist activities and took part in several attacks in Mauritania. In July 2010, Hammam was reportedly involved in the killing of a French hostage in Niger. In 2006, he was sentenced to death in absentia by Algerian authorities for terrorism-related charges. He has also been sanctioned by the U.S. Department of Treasury and the United Nations. El-Hammam was born September 5, 1978, in Rekhaya, Algeria. He has used the aliases Abu Yahya and Akacha Jamel. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to El-Hammam's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. Embassy or consulate and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
It's 4 hours.